I get the when I get the first session. Is it the first session after lunch? That's always a fun session. Oh, it's the second session after lunch. All right. Well, that's better than the first session after lunch. All right. My name is Brian Harry, and I work on Team Foundation Server. Been at Microsoft about 18 years now. It's kind of hard to believe, but it's been a long time. And I've been working on Team Foundation Server for almost 10 years. That's also hard to believe. But it's a pretty big product, and we've done a lot of stuff with it, and I'm pretty proud of what we've done. I've actually got two sessions today. I've got an hour now, and then an hour, a half hour after this session ends, I'll have a second session. This first session, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about trends in the industry, what we see happening, and then talk about work that we've done in Visual Studio 2012 and Team Foundation Server 2012, and sort of how that relates to the trends that we're seeing. In the second session, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the future. So this session's a little bit more about the present. In the next session, I'm going to talk about Update 1 and Update 2 and the next version of Team Foundation Server and that kind of thing. Alrighty. So, I was going to start by talking a bit about some of the trends in computing and sort of what that, and then sort of talk about what that implies about what we as software developers need to be doing. So one of the trends that you may have heard a lot about is what's called consumerization of IT. And that is that technology, you know, used to be, if you go back 10 years, technology was something that I did at work, right? I had my computer at work. Maybe I had a computer at home. Generally at work, I had great technology. I had a big, you know, I had a big fast computer, a big fast network, servers all over the place. I had, you know, sort of the best collaboration. I had the best stuff at work. And in the last few years, that has changed a lot. Most people now have the best technology at home. Many people have a faster network at home than they have at work. They have better computing devices. They have richer experiences. And businesses have been struggling to keep up with that. It's had, it's also had some pretty significant implications. This explosion of technology that I have at home has had some pretty significant implications in the way that I work. I'm online all the time. I'm on email constantly. I'm always reachable. If anything ever happens at work, I'm on it immediately. And that means sort of my computing life has very merged with my personal life, and the distinction between sort of computers and consumer electronics has blurred. And I now expect a consumer kind of experience with all computers that I use everywhere. I expect that quality of experience. And we as developers need to be able to provide that quality of experience. You know, another important trend is changes in form factors. You know, I had, for a long time, I've had a desktop. For, you know, many years, I've had a laptop. You know, then the phone came along, and I started, you know, using the phone as a compute platform. You know, then slates came along, and I started using those. And the more devices that came along, the more specialized they've become, right? So now I use different devices for different things. This isn't particularly convenient for reading. This isn't particularly convenient for reading. It's great for communication. This is great for reading, but quite honestly, there's even better form factors. If you get, this is a little bit big and a little bit heavy, for sort of sitting on the couch and casually reading or watching a movie. So, you know, there are devices that are, you know, 9 inches instead of 12. And we've seen a proliferation of devices, device form factors, platforms that those devices run on, and people expect us to build software that's tuned to the devices that I have, that provides an ideal experience, on the device that I have. They also expect us to be able to take advantage of the various input forms provided by the device. On this device, I do my development. It has a keyboard. I like a keyboard for doing coding. Nothing substitutes. You know, on this device, touch is super nice for browsing and consuming information. On my Xbox, I use Kinect because motion input is super nice for certain kinds of computer interaction. So we need to be thinking about, as we build apps, the fact that those apps sometimes are tuned to a specific device, sometimes span multiple devices, and that we need to be thoughtful about taking advantage of the specifics of each device, whether it's input in the examples I've given, or it's the various sensors in the device, a GPS or an accelerometer or whatever it is. Thirdly, social. Social is an important trend. Social has become an important part of nearly every application. I want to use my computing experience to interact with my friends, my coworkers. I want to use it to meet new people. I want to use it to find people who have similar interests, to get advice from them, to learn from them, and to get to know them. Another trend that's changed, I think, a lot about computing is ease of acquisition. So, you know, it used to be when I bought software, I would either go to the store and buy a box of software, or I'd order it online and a box would come, but it would be days or weeks to get a new application. And now, you know, if I want a new piece of software for this, I click on the marketplace, I download it in about 30 seconds, and I'm using it. And one of the implications of that is, if I don't think it's very good, I just delete it and I go find another app. Another big thing is that, you know, this app costs like $2, whereas that other one I bought mail order probably costs a couple $100s or more. So apps are now, they're very focused, they're very special purpose, they're easy to acquire, they're easy to delete, and that means our apps need to be engaging. If our apps are not super engaging and they're not keeping up with our users and what they want from them, our users will quickly move on. They'll go do something else. And then lastly, data. Data is, you know, I don't want to say that's a new trend, because it's one of those things that's, you know, it's just like a knee curve. It's been growing and growing and growing, but we're on the vertical part of that knee curve. In the next 5 years, we're going to generate more data than has been generated in all of history. So the rate of new data creation is phenomenal. And there's a lot of value in that data. We can learn a lot from patterns in data. The problem that we have is there is so much data that we can't make sense of it. Like a human cannot make sense of it. So new disciplines like machine learning have come into play to figure out how to have machines, big farms of machines, process tremendous amounts of data, find the patterns, and teach us what we need to know out of all that data. We need to be thinking about what questions we want to be asking, and we need tools and platforms to enable that data processing. But it's fundamentally changed the way we work with software. As a software developer, you know, today I use telemetry out of my apps way more than I ever have before. So I know what people are doing in my application. I watch when people stop using my application. I know why. All of that is data. Like everything everybody does in my app is recorded, and I know what they're doing. Now there's interesting privacy and security issues with that, and we're super, super careful about that. But there's so much value to be gained out of that data, and we should all be thinking about, as we're building applications, how we do that. So we've been talking a lot over the last several months about what we call modern applications. And modern applications are applications that address a bunch of those trends. They are device capable, so they're very focused on providing rich experiences on the devices that you have. They're cloud powered, so they're available wherever you are, on whatever device you're on, anytime you want it, high availability, all your apps when you want them, where you need them. And the cloud is an incredibly scalable, powerful architecture for doing that. They're people-centric, so they integrate deeply with my social network. And they're data-enabled, so they consume data feeds, whether it's, you know, data in the form of Twitter or in terms of maps or in terms of search results or the wide array of data that's out there that we can feed on and build apps around. There's also been a set of trends around the application lifecycle. So the first set I talked about were trends in the kinds of computing experiences people want and the kinds of apps we build. There have been a bunch of trends around how we build those apps and sort of the demands on us as developers in building those apps. The first is the fact that change is accelerating. And I swear every year things are just changing faster and faster. Whether it's new platforms coming out, new devices and form factors, new business models. Now all of a sudden, you know, we've got businesses that are entirely cloud-based, new business models, freemium business models, new business models evolving constantly. The way I engage with my customers, the way I attract customers are constantly evolving and changing. And many businesses are finding technology to be a limiting factor in how fast they can evolve their business to get into new markets and find new revenue streams. And that's requiring us as developers to figure out how to be more agile, how to respond faster to the changing business and the changing technology needs. Secondly, we must develop and test incrementally. So this has been kind of a trend that's been happening for a while now, sort of the sort of shift from waterfall through agile. But that trend is also accelerating. And how many of you have sort of heard about lean, the lean startup, build, measure, learn, any of that stuff sound familiar? How many of you are familiar with agile, scrum, that kind of thing? All right. About half of you or so. So in the last, the last 10 years or so, the sort of predominant shift in the industry has been away from sort of long product cycles towards a more iterative type of development. And sort of the next generation of that is called lean development. That's sort of the next up and coming hot thing. Next slide, I'm going to talk a good bit more about that. Cloud and the availability of cloud and cloud architectures has also really changed sort of our relationship to our apps. You know, I know I've been building apps for a long time. Most of them have run on somebody else's hardware somewhere out there. And the problem is that once I release it, I kind of have no control over it anymore. And note that I don't know how you're going to install it. I don't know what you're going to do with it. I don't know how you're going to abuse it. And what that means is I have to do extensive testing. I have to be super, super careful about what I ever ship. And that requires a set of development practices that cause me to be very slow in responding to sort of customer needs and customer demands as they change. Sort of times, at least in months, you're talking about release cycles. Historically, we've shipped every couple years. And the cloud has changed that. So we're now building a cloud service called Team Foundation Service, and it ships every 3 weeks. So every 3 weeks we ship new features. If there's ever an issue, we patch it the day that there's an issue. Fundamentally, the availability of cloud and the cloud architecture has changed the way we work. It's changed our development process, and it's changed the way we're able to relate to our customers and the speed with which we're able to deliver them value. Customer connection is an increasingly important part of software development today. I talked about it a little bit a minute ago, but more and more, whether it's web analytics or it's application diagnostics, we're seeing developers instrument their applications, gather information about the behaviors of their users, and then use that information to figure out how to build a better application. So if I ship a new feature today and I see, you know, a few weeks from now, nobody's using it. Like, that's important information. I want to know why nobody's using it. And I might try some things. Oh, maybe nobody's using it for this reason, so let me try that. And hey, it's the cloud, so I can deploy a new version tomorrow and see if that changes anything. So having sort of that feedback loop, that customer connection, and really understanding what people are doing with your application is super important. The disciplines are converging. Now, that's also been a trend that's been happening for a while. First, it was developers and testers. We saw a tighter and tighter integration of that discipline, of those two disciplines, with more and more responsibility for the application quality falling on the developer and really working on improving that relationship between developers and testers. And kind of the next phase of that is the relationship between development and operations, also driven somewhat by the cloud phenomenon. Sort of the buzzword for that is DevOps, and it can go from sort of at one extreme what's called NoOps, and what that means is your operations team is your development team, through to a more formal separation between development and operations. But either way, what we're seeing is the need for developers to be engaged and involved in the operations of the software that they build, again, so that they can build a better application for people. You know, historically, you would hand an application off to operations, they would go deploy it, and the developers would never be allowed to see it, to touch it, to update it. Everything had to go through the operations team. And more we're seeing developers engaging directly. For example, in my team, I have developers who work directly on the live service. Again, privacy and security issues we have to be very thoughtful about. But if there's an issue, I want my developer on that thing right away because I want to figure out the root cause of that issue and I want to make sure that issue never happens again. And that sometimes requires access to production. And then lastly, teams are more and more distributed. We're seeing, you know, development teams distributed around the world. My team alone, we've got developers on the west coast of the U.S., east coast of the U.S., in Europe, in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, in India, in China. I'd say probably about 8 or 9 locations on my team alone that we have developers working on various parts of our application. And providing the tools and the opportunities for those developers to collaborate and work well together is an incredibly important part of what we're attempting to do. So these are some of the trends. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about this notion of lean development and build, measure, learn. So the idea with lean development is, let's say I've got an idea for an application that I want to build. I don't know for sure if it's a good idea or not. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. How am I going to tell? Well, I could build it. I could spend 6 months or a year or whatever it takes to build it and go put it in customers' hands. What happens if I find out nobody likes it? Maybe I've wasted an awful lot of time. So the notion of lean development was actually born out of manufacturing in Toyota. Toyota invented lean manufacturing. And the fundamental notion was to eliminate waste in any process by managing flow and looking for any opportunity where there's any activity that does not deliver direct customer value. And what people have been trying to do over the last several years is figure out how to apply that very interesting notion to the process of software development. And sort of the prevailing thinking goes like this. So if I have this idea to build an application, rather than risking the chance that I go build it and I've built something nobody wants, why don't I instead take this idea, I have a vision for where I want to be, why don't I find some very small increment, something I can do very quickly, why don't I build that, put that out for a group of users to try, see what they do with it. Again, instrument, measure, learn what they're doing, see how my users behave. And then based on that, figure out what the next thing I should do is, right? So I iterate rapidly through Develop an idea. I have this idea. If I do this, the following things will happen. Go build the smallest increment I can, which is called the minimum viable product in sort of lean terminology. Then I deploy it. I get people to use it. I get some feedback on that, and I come up with my next idea, and I iterate. So that's the core notion of build, measure, learn. So when we sort of apply that to the application lifecycle as we've been describing it now for several years, here's kind of the phases that I think about as I think about the application lifecycle. You've clearly got some notion of definition. This is where I'm coming up with my idea. This is refining my idea. I'm going to go build this increment. Then I've got development. I'm going to go build it. I got to go implement something. Once I've got it built, I've got to deploy it. Once it's deployed, I've got to operate it. Once people are using it, I'm going to adapt, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about adaptation in a minute. And then I'm going to collect feedback out of people's use of it, and I'm going to go back into defining the next increment that I'm going to build. So if you take this kind of iterative approach, then fundamentally your ability to deliver value to your customers is controlled by how quickly you can make it through this loop. You've got to be able to get through this very quickly. And if we look at, you know, sort of historically the amount of time it's taken, let's just take even a simple step. Let's take deployment. So I've built something and I want to deploy something into my organization to use. How long does that take? Well, often it takes months. People have to procure, you know, your IT team has to procure hardware. They have to figure out how to deploy it. They have to figure out how to monitor it. They have to figure out how to support it. And it could take months from the time you've got an application that you're interested in that you've developed until your users can actually use it. You need to get that down. And in fact, in sort of the most modern teams that I've seen, they've got that down to minutes. From the time that I have a new version of my application ready until that application is deployed and running in production, they can do that many times a day. Now I wanted to talk a little bit about adaptation, because that's a little novel for some people. The notion of adaptation is, so I've got this software that I'm going to deploy and I'm going to get some feedback on. But there's sort of two things that are interesting. One, I'm not sure I actually want to expose all of my users to sort of some change that I've made at once. Right? When you think about a cloud service, and this is particularly true of a cloud service, there's only one instance. So like Team Foundation Service, there's one Team Foundation Service. When I update it, I update Team Foundation Service. I can't send you a beta copy of Team Foundation Server and have you try it. But nonetheless, if I make a change and I want to get some early feedback, I still would love to be able to have only you use it. And we have something that we call feature flags, but it's sort of generally called exposure control that enables us to select which customers get access to various capabilities within our hosted service. And then another important component of adaptation is what's constantly called or frequently called A/B testing or flight testing or split testing, and that is the ability I have an idea of a change. If I make this change, people will do X more than they do it today. Maybe I like to use an example. So in Team Foundation Service, one of the things I have observed through instrumentation of our application is we get a ton of people signing up for accounts. A really startling percentage, okay, like 20%, 15%, something like that, of the people who create an account never then go on to create a project in that account. And if you don't create a project, you're not really using it. You might have played with it a little bit, but you're not really using it. You've got to create a project in order to really use the service. So what's the problem? Why are people creating accounts? They're obviously interested enough to create an account, but they're dropping off. They're dropping off before they actually create a project. So one of the things we've looked at is some changes. We think The problem is the landing page that you get after you create an account does not make it clear what your next step is. So what we believe is happening is people create an account, they go to that page, and they're not sure what to do next. They get confused, and then they go away. So what we do is we build a new landing page, and we create an A/B test so that some percentage of our users see the old landing page, and another percentage of our users see the new landing page. And then we measure which path. Users who go through the new landing page, are they more likely to create a project or less likely to create a project than people who go through the old landing page? So this would be a very classic build, measure, learn cycle, where we would build this, we would use A/B testing to test the effectiveness of the change. We would learn from that change. If it turns out that didn't have a significant effect, which we're testing right now, we would come up with another idea and say, okay, it's not that problem. Maybe it's a different problem. And we would continue to iterate, literally sometimes many times a week, just throwing out new ideas of what can we do to improve that experience. All right, so that's the life cycle and sort of the important activities in it. And again, the fundamental thing here is speeding the loop. You want to speed the cycle here, being able to get through this cycle as quickly and as easily as you can. So in VS 2012, we focused on sort of three of these key activities that I'm now going to spend some time talking about. One, definition. So that activity in the life cycle, development and operation. We didn't ignore all of the others, but these were the areas where we sort of did our largest investments in 2012. And in our next version, we'll be investing in some of those other activities that I talked about. So I'm going to go through and do a few demos for you to show you some of the features that we built that help with this. So in the definition phase, fundamentally what you're doing is coming up with an idea. And what you want to do is validate that idea as quickly as possible and make sure you don't waste a bunch of time pursuing something that's not going to be an effective idea. So I'm going to have to sit because this is a fairly low table. So I want to talk about a tool we built called storyboarding. So storyboarding allows me to mock up my ideas and test them with users quickly and easily. This is how we build Visual Studio. You know, years ago we used to write big, thick specs that said, you know, in detail how things worked. We really don't do that so much anymore. It's not to say we don't write specs. We do write some specs. But we're way more focused on storyboards as a way of communicating what the intent of what we're building is. We build long. Sometimes our storyboards will have 100 or 200 or 300 slides in them that show the flow through a scenario. And literally, once we've sort of got them to the point that we like them, then we will bring in customers and do usability testing on storyboards. We'll bring a customer in and have them walk through the storyboard, make sure they understand how they're going to interact with this application, what the application's going to do for them. So let's talk about how we do that. We've looked at a bunch of different tools, and we've actually found PowerPoint to be by far the most effective tool at storyboarding because everybody knows how to use it, it's super lightweight, and it enables you to iterate very easily. So I've mocked up a screen from an application called Fabricam Fiber, which is an app that, sort of a demo app, sample app that we've built that is for this hypothetical company that's a communication company, and they're managing their customer support incidents. And here's a page in that app. It's a web app that represents a customer. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to have a history of the customer's incidents so that I can go back when I'm talking to the customer and I know what kind of issues they've had, when they had their last issue, and who helped them. So let's mock that up so that before I go and build it, I'm able to sit down with my stakeholder and make sure what I'm building is the right thing. So what I want is I want a list. All right, looks like a data grid looks like a good list to me. And on that list, let's say I want the date of the incident. I want the customer service representative that helped them. And maybe I want a summary of the incident that they had. Now, this is just a PowerPoint table, so if I need to add or remove columns or rows, type in sample data, it's all super easy. So let's sort of, sort of size that the way I want it. And now, you know, I'd like a label. Great, so some text. I can just drop that here. And maybe I want that to say history. And, you know, maybe I don't like that font size too much. And I want to make it bigger. Maybe I want to make it red. So, you know, PowerPoint's a pretty powerful tool for mocking up and getting the data. So, you know, here I am. This is what I want the app to look like. As I say, we build very involved versions of these. I think I built this whole screen in probably about 10 or 15 minutes of mocking up. You can use PowerPoint animation to animate user experiences through it. You can provide links that take you to other slides. You can actually simulate your paths through the app. So I showed you a web app. Maybe I want to mock up a phone app, so I can bring a phone on here and, you know, find the phone controls. Maybe I want an application bar on it. Or maybe I want a Windows 8 application or a Windows desktop app. We've also got templates for iPhone and iPad. But a super easy way for me to be able to iterate on a design, get the user experience to where I want it, get my stakeholders or prospective customers to look at it and say, yes, that is what I want. If you build that, I will be happy. And while minimizing my investment. So that's storyboarding. Let's talk about another tool and another problem. So another problem is, you know, even if I agree with my customer about what I'm going to build, and we all say, "Yep, that's the solution," inevitably it takes time. And every customer I've ever met, they want more than you can deliver, and they want it sooner than you can possibly deliver it. So what happens whenever you have that problem? You have the problem of prioritization. So you have to figure out what you're going to do first. So I want to make sure I deliver the things first that are most important for my customer, and I want to make sure my whole team is clear about what our priorities are. So in TFS 2012, we built an Agile project management experience that allows me to have a simple global backlog that anybody on my team is allowed to see. My stakeholder, my team members. I can add new things to it really easily. I can prioritize, so just by simple dragging and dropping, I can create a nice ordered list of the things, the ideas, the features, the capabilities. Each of these is a work item. I can have associated with each one or more storyboards that show kind of what's involved in doing this particular work. As I get ready to begin doing some work, I'm getting ready to start a sprint. I can simply drag and drop these capabilities over into a sprint. And within the sprint, I can then break it down into tasks. It's just as easy to add a new task. So a new task, and I'll assign that to me. No, actually to Adam. So super easy to break that work down. I can provide cost estimates. I can define my team. Over here, I see the members of my team and how much work is assigned to them. I also see a burndown chart of the progress that I've made against the work in this sprint. If I let's see, if I take an item and maybe I change the remaining work to be, you know, a lot more, then this will automatically update and show that Julia is now overloaded. She has more work than she's going to be able to accomplish in this sprint. You'll notice my burn down chart also went up, showing that I have more work than I started with. If I now take that and I mark it as done, so I've now finished that work somehow miraculously. My burn down chart now updates, my capacity updates. So a super easy way to sort of plan my work. And then for my team managing the daily work, I have a task board that shows my user stories and the tasks in those user stories and who they're assigned to. I can very easily advance those user stories through. If I'm going to start working on that one, maybe I finished working on this one. This is a great tool to use in your daily stand-up as you go over the work that you completed yesterday and the work you're planning on doing today. I can pivot by team member and look at the work assigned to each team member and look at, you know, it looks like Cameron's got kind of the most work unstarted. Maybe I need to load balance, so maybe I'm going to move that task over to Brian. That should have worked. This is 2012. This doesn't have update one on it. Update one gave me the ability to drag and drop between users. So all in all, the Agile Project Management tool provides me a good way to be super clear about what my priorities are, both with my stakeholders and within my team, so that we're making sure we're working on the most important things first. Again, focusing on feedback loops as a way to avoid waste. Let's make sure I'm working on the thing my customer wants in the order my customer wants it. All right, so let's talk about development. There's stuff we can do to remove friction in the development process. Anything we can do to make this overall process go faster, the better off we are. So we looked at a bunch of the causes for friction in the developer process. What slows development down? One of the things we found is that one of the most common causes of slowdowns in development is interruptions. How many of you get like 8 hours a day to sit quietly at your computer and type code? Probably not very many. You end up with people who need stuff from you. There's a bug somebody needs you to fix. There's a production incident someone needs you to look at. Somebody needs you to do a design review or a code review for them. And there's nothing more frustrating than when you're deep in the middle of focusing on some hard problem to have somebody come in and interrupt you and need you to go do something that's higher priority. So how can we make it easier for you to preserve your context and get back into the space when you get back from the interruption? We can't completely eliminate interruptions. They will happen. But how can we optimize them? Second cause of friction in the development process is worrying about quality late. Often, quality is put off till late in the process, and that means defects sort of sit in the system, and you're constantly having to work around them. You're constantly having to deal with some problem that somebody else introduced, and you're having to debug it because it's blocking your work. So how do we make sure you keep the quality high so that you can stay focused on your work, not having to debug random problems in the system? And then third, unmet user expectations. So, hey, we did that work. We worked with our customer, and we storyboarded it, and we sort of got a clear picture of what they want. We went through the prioritization exercise. But still, you know, sometimes people will think what you showed them is what they want, but when they actually sit down to use it, they suddenly realize, no, not quite. That's actually not going to quite solve the problem. I thought it would, but it's not. So getting that actual feedback on working software early and often in the process allows you to adjust quickly with minimal loss of investment. So again, eliminating waste in the process. So let's go through and demo a few of these things. So let's start in Visual Studio. And let's imagine I've got some code open. I don't know exactly what I'm doing, but I'm working on some code. Maybe I've got a breakpoint set. Over here I've set a bookmark. Made another change down here. And I'm deep in trying to debug this and figure out this code. Maybe I'm working on one more thing. Go to my work. What I'm doing here is working on this task that I created for myself. And I've got that task open because it's got a description of what I'm working on. Maybe it's got a storyboard attached to it for the feature that I'm implementing. So I've got all of this stuff open. And now somebody comes along and interrupts me. And I need to go work on some other bug. Meanwhile, I've got a bunch of changes here. I need to set these aside. I need to go work on something else, and then I'm going to come back to this. So in order to sort of make this as seamless as possible, we've built a feature, a new feature called My Work in Team Explorer that allows you to focus on what you're working on now. And within that feature, there's a new capability called Suspend. And if you've used TFS, we've had a feature for a long time called Shelve Sets. You can think of Suspend as an evolution of Shelve Sets. So I'm going to hit Suspend. And it's going to automatically take the name of the work item that I'm working on. And it's going to take all of that work and shelve it, set it aside. And you'll notice that it's now cleared my workspace. It closed all my windows. It undid all my changes. So if I were to go over, for example, to pending changes, I would see that I don't have any files checked out anymore because it undid all my checked out files. It has cleared my machine to be able to now go work on whatever I need to work on. So let's imagine I went and did that, I made the changes, I fixed the bug, I've now checked everything in, and I'm ready to get back to what I was working on before. So I can look at my suspended work, I can see what task I was working on, I can even see what files I had checked out, I can view the changes I was making in those files. So I can see here is that comment I had made. And I can, I can resume that work. So by clicking resume, what it's going to do is pull those changes back down off of the server. It reopened all the windows that I had opened. It has restored the bookmarks that I had. It's left my cursor exactly where my cursor was. It's restored breakpoints that I had. It has restored me back to exactly the state I was in when I set this work aside. So that will make it way easier for me to get back into the state that I was in and make that interruption much less impactful for me. Alright, so the next thing I want to talk about is testing and quality. So if we can keep the quality high, then we are going to be way better off. So we've done a bunch of work on our unit testing support in Visual Studio 2012. The first thing is this new feature called Test Explorer, which is a new window for managing my tests. And every time I build, in fact, it just did it, it automatically goes out and discovers any unit tests in my project. Goes through, parses all my code, finds any unit tests that I have, and then makes it super easy for me to run those tests. Now, in addition to when I think about the key changes that we made to unit testing, in addition to the new Test Explorer window, we did a bunch of other things. One, we exposed the extensibility of the unit testing framework so that you can use any unit testing framework you like. You can use NUnit, MBUnit, XUnit, etc. We also did a bunch of work to make our unit tests run way faster than they used to run. We added support for C++ unit testing. You'll also notice here one of my unit tests is a functional coded UI test. So what you saw it doing there was running my app in the browser, automating the activity in the browser, and that test in fact passed. That was coded UI test method one ran. You can also see I had a failure. It's super easy to explore that failure, see what the problem was, go to the stack frame where it failed, and go fix that problem. Another thing that we did in this release was add what's called fakes and stubs, or a mocking capability. So often you want to test some component of your application, but the problem is that it depends on other components that you can't run because they're production components, or you don't want to run it in the context of the whole app. You just want to test your little component. And the fakes and stubs provides an ability for you to build sort of a harness around your component so that you can test your component in isolation, but it thinks it's in the context of the full application. All right, so those are some of the capabilities we've done to help developers make sure that their applications stay high quality, stay what we call quality early and often. Sort of next thing I want to talk about is the problem of, now I've built something. Maybe I've executed a sprint, I finished a few user stories, and before I go on and build a bunch of other stuff, I'd like to get some feedback on what I've already built so that I can adapt if it turns out that people don't like what I've built. So we've built a new capability, first for the product owner to be able to request feedback. It's a simple way for me to, you know, select people that I'd like to get feedback from, as many as I like. I can, you know, type the URL of where I've deployed my application. I can type some comments. I can give them a list of user stories that I'd like to get their feedback on. And then I can send this to them in email, and this will be packaged up with a simple link that they can click on that will launch a feedback tool and enable them to give me feedback. So this VM is not configured for sending emails, so I'm going to do this a little bit of a manual way. First of all, let me pull up my app and run the feedback tool. So normally this is what we save you from by sending you the email. The email does all that for you and just launches the feedback tool. So I'd get the feedback tool. It would have all the instructions that I put in email. And you'll notice what it's done is it's kind of split my desktop. I've got the feedback tool over here on the left. I've got my app over here on the right. And I can go through this feedback tool and, go to the customers page, go to Maria, and I can look at this and say, hey, wait a minute. You told me you added that history thing that we agreed on my storyboard, but I don't see it. I mean, so I can super easily grab this, take a screenshot, and say, where is the customer history? And, you know, while I'm looking at this, I'm also seeing, I'm looking at a customer. What I'm seeing is a service rep's profile. And I'm thinking, you know, that doesn't really make sense. Do I really want to have my service rep here? I really would rather see my customer's profile. So simple, easy, free form ability to take screenshots. Maybe I want to open up this image and maybe grab a little thing and say, hey, I expected it to be there, and I can save that. And immediately my screenshot in the feedback tool is updated. I can also do video recording, so as I'm using the app, it will record video. I can do audio recording if rather than typing comments, I just want to talk through, hey, as I'm using it, I can synchronize the audio and the video so the video can be watching what I'm doing while I'm speaking to it and giving feedback. So we've tried to make it super easy for a non-technical stakeholder to be able to give feedback. Now, I can also sort of rate the user story that you've asked me to look at, and well, since it wasn't even there, I'm going to give it 0 stars because you didn't even implement what I asked you to implement. And then when I go back to, back to the web UI, I can go to work item tracking, look at my work items, and there's a nice feedback query, and I can see all the feedback that I got. This is the feedback that Adam just sent me. It's got the screenshots and comments, the video recording, the audio recording. So all of that making it super easy for customers to give feedback. So that's sort of three examples of ways that we've tried to streamline the development process. Again, eliminating waste, making it as quickly as possible to get through to delivering a valuable capability that I can then get into production. So then let's talk about operations. So there's a bunch of friction in the operation process. I talked about how long it can take to deploy things into production. I've talked about sort of the often very poor relationship between developers and operations when an incident happens in production, a bug. Those can be the hardest to reproduce, the most difficult to track down. And your ops team, especially if you operate in a more traditional ops model, their first goal is to get the app back up and running. So what's the first thing they do? They hit the reboot button, right? Because they just want to reboot the server and get the app running again. And as soon as they've done that, you've lost a lot of your valuable data. How is it we can improve that experience, both for the developer to understand what's going on in their application in production, diagnose the failure and fix it so that it never happens again? And how can I interact with my operations team to make sure that they have, that I've got a good line of communication between them? We've done a bunch of stuff to help with that. One thing that we've done in TFS, go to another demo, is focused on the problem of deploying an application quickly into production. So in Visual Studio, we have a build automation system, and that build automation system is a full workflow system that can do deployments as part of the build. So it's super easy for me to create a new build definition. I can define the various characteristics of my build definition. Among them, I can define what I want to cause to trigger this build. It might be a manual trigger, which means I have to go and explicitly say, I want you to run this build. It could be continuous integration, which means with every build, with every check-in, it will automatically do a build. It could be a rolling build that just, every couple hours runs and does another build. It could be gated, which means that it happens with every check-in and the check-in doesn't complete unless the build succeeds. Or it could be at a schedule. And I can hook this up to do automated deployments into any environment I want. I could deploy to a physical environment. So there's some machines over there. I just configure it to go do a deployment to those machines. I can also, through lab management, configure it to do deployments into virtual environments. So maybe I want to have every night, I want to have a test environment deployed. And I can configure lab management to automatically go allocate some VMs from SCVMM, deploy my software to it, and notify my test team or my stakeholders that a new version of that application is available in production. All right, so that's about sort of reducing the friction and getting an application deployed. The last thing I wanted to mention is I talked about the difficulty of, what's wrong one? Of diagnosing production problems. Oh, here they are. We've now, with Visual Studio 2012, we've enabled IntelliTrace in production, and we've created simple PowerShell commandlets to enable and disable IntelliTrace. So I can say start IntelliTrace, and that will run a PowerShell script that will turn on IntelliTrace. I'll then be able to run through my application. Let's take this one. When IntelliTrace is running, the app runs a little bit slower because what's happening is IntelliTrace has instrumented this application and is collecting a bunch of data about everything that this application is doing. There we go. So, you know, when I click on this link, there's an error in my application. I don't know exactly what that error was, but I've now reproduced this application in, or this error in production. I can now go back and stop my my IntelliTrace. That has collected a log. So I've got an IntelliTrace log. And I can now open that IntelliTrace log in Visual Studio and get a full-fledged debugging experience over everything that happened in the production environment, making it much easier for me to diagnose that error in production. All right, so I'm going to wrap up. I'm about out of time. So fundamentally, we've done in 2012, we've done in Visual Studio 2012, we focused on two things. One, building modern applications, which I talked about, sort of the trends that are driving sort of a new model for application. And number two, building tools that help you build using a modern application lifecycle that allows you to iterate very quickly and removes friction and waste. And then last thing I wanted to mention before I'm done is last night we shipped Visual Studio Update 1. I'm super excited about that. It's something we've been working on for the last few months. It's got dozens of cool new features. In fact, in the next session, in about 30 minutes, I'm going to spend some time talking about those new features, and hopefully you'll be around to hear about it. And general categories of those new features, we've done a bunch of stuff around testing to make testing even better. We've updated the Agile project management with Kanban support and other things. We enabled better SharePoint development and tons of IDE productivity enhancement. So get started today. You can go to visualstudio.com and download Visual Studio. You can go to tfs.visualstudio.com and try out the Team Foundation service. So look forward to you trying it out and giving us any feedback that you have. Thank you very much.